Like, usually I'm here a little bit earlier.
Full meeting, and I feel like I haven't been here for a while, so I feel like I need to get back into my groove. So thanks everybody for coming. I was just going to review the minutes. It's not on my list, but did everybody get a chance to look at the meeting notes from August 27th? I wasn't here, but is there a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Second.
Okay. Great. I thought we would introduce our newest staff member, which we're all very excited about. I don't know if Doreen, you want to give your intro, but this is Doreen Gunderson.
Yes.
And you may have all seen that she sent the email for inviting us all to be here. So maybe if you wanted to.
Sure.
Or actually, why don't we do this? Why don't we go around and we can all introduce ourselves?
Okay.
I guess too. Leah Shannon is a veterinary student, a fourth-year veterinary student from Tennessee that's visiting with our clinic for the next 2 weeks. So I'll have her, but maybe we'll do our introductions and then we can have the two new exciting people that are here and introduce themselves. So go ahead, Lydia. Oh, and another public member too. So maybe we can just all do the other members.
Okay. So start with me.
Sure.
Okay. Lydia Gurman, administrative assistant.
And I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I'm a veterinarian practicing in Clark County. And the chair.
And I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm staff at Clark County Public
Health. And I'm Marla Sanger, and I came on this committee as a Peace Health representative, and now I'm serving as consumer public health service.
Lawrence Semoy, served at Peace Health.
Chris Goodwin, I'm a program coordinator with the Healthy Communities team here at Public Health.
I'm Katie Webb, I'm the youth representative for Clark County.
Arun Dorothy, I represent the medical doctors in Clark County.
David Hudson, Clark County Public Health.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a community health nurse, but I sit on this council as a non-elected representative from the city of Vancouver.
this is Sandra.
I'm Janice Koch. I'm the environmental health director with Public Health.
I'm Dave Fuller with Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency.
I'm Stephanie Grace-Mosh. I'm a nurse at Peace Health, but here as a nurse practicing in Clark County.
And I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief in Battleground, Washington, and I represent the LEC, which is the Law Enforcement Council, and that's the sheriff of Clark County and all of the police chiefs.
I'm Jeff Robinson. I'm the administrative services director of Public Health.
Hi, Doreen. We met Thursday. I'm Remy Houston. I represent the community here in Clark County.
I think we know each other. But
you hired me.
Public Health Director.
I'm Paul Childers. I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Mark Collier, representing septic designers, operation maintenance specialists, and installers.
And I'm Mike Kugler, the director of investigation and response for Public Health.
Great. All right, so Dr. Mellink, did you want to give during the true introduction? Dr. Mellink style? We'll do Doreen first, and we can introduce the public.
So let me explain, before I introduce Doreen, I just want to let you know that she
she's in this position because Lydia is moving on to becoming, achieving her dream of becoming a teacher. She is finishing up her, she's doing her student teaching right now, so it's cut her time down to 3 days a week. And we'll get her master's in the spring and then begin teaching. So, and Lydia will be with us for during that time and helping out in various projects, so we can really use her help. Plus, she'll be orienting Doreen. So now I'll introduce Doreen, who we are very fortunate to recruit. Doreen has an extensive history in management and executive assistant position. She's also got an English degree. So I'm expecting incredible stuff from her in terms of writing skills. So she will be our, yes, and helping with PNAC as well. So Doreen will be our administrative assistant and will be actually staffing PNAC meetings, among other things. I don't know if you want to say anything.
Just hi, everybody. I'm excited to be here and get to know you when I see you by name and face eventually. But everybody's been so welcoming, and I'm thrilled. So thank you.
And then we can introduce our public comment members.
Hi, my name is Leah Shannon. I am here visiting with Dr. Fairbanks' clinic for the next 2 weeks on externship from the University of Tennessee. I am a senior year veterinary student.
My name is Kimberly Hutchins. I work as a nurse over in Portland, and I am here as an assignment for one of my BSN classes.
Welcome. Thanks for coming. Okay. Great. And is there any publics from the comments that we need? Any comments from the public? Publics from the comments? Okay. And then Roxanne's going to...
Yes, so I would like to, if we could go to, we'd like to recognize Dr. Youssen, who was recently recognized as a community champion from Rowena. And as part of that, I believe that the award ceremony was in September 26th.
Yeah,
and he was nominated by Public Health for his work supporting the Access to Baby and Child Dentistry, which is the ABCD Oral Health Program, which works to hook up people, low-income and Medicaid recipients to dental care in the community. And Dr. Youssen has been such a wonderful champion for us in the community and for the program. And we were thrilled that when we nominated him, that Molina recognized him. And as part of the recognition, he received a $3,000 grant to allocate to a nonprofit of his choice, and he chose the Free Clinic at Southwest Washington. So we wanted to show a little picture at the event. There he is. Is this your family member? Your family members? Dr. Youssen, is this your family?
My wife and my youngest daughter. She's going to school at UW. And she's thinking about going into public health now.
That's wonderful.
It's good to take her to this ceremony.
Well, do you have anything else to add?
No. Yeah, the grant is going to the Free Clinic of Southwest Washington, where we do a lot of good. It was quite an honor. Totally caught me off guard. Back at you guys. But it was a good thing.
Yeah. So. Well, we really appreciate all your support, and I think it was a. Not only was it a nomination that was heartfelt, but it was a very, very good choice for Molina and Molina's perspective. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Congratulations. And I already approved the minutes because I'm going rogue and not following my agenda very well. Okay, so we're on to, correct me if I'm wrong, on to Dr. Melnick for the legislative update.
So we'll talk about the vaping executive order as well as the emergency rules development. So we now have emergency rules in place based on the governor's executive order that do three things. One is they ban flavored products for 120 days and ban flavored vaping products. They require a warning sign where vaping products are sold. And now vaping-related severe lung illness which either results in hospitalization or death, is a notifiable condition. So healthcare providers who see somebody with severe lung illness that's associated with vaping and is either hospitalized or dies outside the hospital, they're required to report that to us, and we're investigating them and trying to get some information on. The whole idea for investigators is to try to get as much data as we can as what might be the potential cause. We've sent out several provider advisories. The last one instructed providers as to healthcare providers as to what data to get, and including their health conditions, what substance they may have used, where they obtained it, where they bought it, what kind of device they used, vaping device they used, and their method of using substances. So I don't have any more information other than we've had about nationwide, the last I looked, about 1,500 cases, and we've had 12 cases in Washington. So that's kind of a little hot. The other point I want to make about this is that this is a statewide effort, so we do not have resources to enforce all the vaping ban as well as the signage, but the Liquor and Cannabis Board does, and will be there'll be a statewide enforcement process for folks who don't comply. So it'll be the same process across the state. I don't know if anybody has any questions.
When vaping first started, it was really as a smoking cessation device, and then it sort of evolved into this. So for people who want to stop using cigarettes and use a vaping device with just the tobacco, that's still allowed, right?
That is still allowed, and I think one of the reasons for the flavored product bans, if you take a look at the healthy use survey, mm-hmm. you'll see that so tobacco use among kids went down, but vaping has kind of really increased in the last couple of years. And the last I looked at the Health Use Survey, 30% of 12th graders were reported using vaping products. So, the flavored products are marketed particularly to kids. And some of the cases around the country have been in adolescents. So I think that was part of the reason behind the flavored ban. But yes, adults. And there's some data that adults who are using tobacco, combustible tobacco, can use vaping as a means of harm reduction and getting off the tobacco. But there's other FDA-approved products. There are FDA-approved products that are doing that as well. But the flavored, a lot of kids are using flavored vaping products. And it's unfortunate because now we have a whole new cohort of adolescents who are basically dependent on nicotine, because these products can handle on nicotine as well. That's a concern. I don't know if there's any other questions about vaping. Should I go on to FPHS? Mm-hmm. So one of the downsides of the flavored product ban, as well as all the hoopla and reduced demand for vaping, is that if you recall, when we were able to get funding from the legislature for foundational public health services that you all supported, revenue to support the foundation of the $22 million ask, a significant amount of that revenue came from taxes on vaping, excuse me, vaping products. So one of the side effects of the vaping reduction in vaping purchasing is that there's now a revenue shortage of tax available for foundational public health services. So one of our asks, we may ask you all for help for the legislature is to ask the Department of Health has already made a request for $3.2 million of state funding to backfill the revenue shortfall. So we'll keep you posted on all of that. But that was my little FPHS piece.
if anybody has any questions about that. Silence. The vaccination status, is that about what's happening with schools?
And the change in exemption status.
Okay, so yeah, so let me, is that okay if I talk? I'll be brief. I know I can go on for a long period of time. So you may recall that in this past legislative session, and we got, by the way, Representative Harris received the Washington State Medical Association Legislator of the Year Award. And Representative Harris and Representative Stonier and actually Senator Cleveland were really helpful on this. We passed the, we got the bill passed that removed the personal or philosophical exemption for the MMR vaccine. So, so now you need a medical exemption or religious exemption, which were really, medical exemptions are incredibly rare, and they're very, religious exemptions are really rare also. So we don't, so that goes into effect this school year, and we don't have any data yet because the schools, parents begin submitting their forms, the certificate of immunization status forms, at the beginning of the school year, and the schools are still compiling them, and they generally don't have a report out until at least November, if not later. Anecdotally, I've heard from some school nurses that the religious exemptions are going way up. I don't have hard data on that. I just have information from talking to school nurses that a lot more people are asking for religious exemptions. So we'll have some more data on that down the line, but I think what we want to give it a little bit of time to see what happens, but we might come back next legislative session with another bill to tighten it all up.
What kind of documentation do they need for a religious exemption? Is it from a pastor, or like how they just can say it's against my religion? Or
yeah, they just say they have a religious reason, and they do have to get a signature, I believe, from a physician saying they had to talk. Just like with a religion, with a philosophic exemption, the healthcare provider has to sign a form saying they had to talk with the person about how important vaccines are and risks of not getting them. But they don't have to have a pastor or a priest or a rabbi or an imam or somebody like that.
Right.
I don't know of any
religion that
itself that's against.
Yeah.
You know, in New York with the Hasidic population, Jewish population, that was a real small sub-segment of the Jewish population. There's nothing, and I can speak as a Jewish person, that there's nothing in the religion that says you shall not vaccinate. So anyway, so we'll have to take a look at it and see what happens.
Could you give a quick update too on the Hep A availability and then just flu real quick? Would you mind, just real quick?
Yeah, okay. So hepatitis A, we're really working to get hepatitis A vaccine out. So we're in the midst of an outbreak. I don't know the latest numbers in Washington State on hepatitis A, and it's predominantly being seen in homeless populations and people who inject drugs. And it's a fecal oral transmission. Sorry to bring that up during dinner here. But people who inject drugs also are usually in situations where they have poor hygiene conditions. And so they're at risk, and homeless populations are at risk. We're concerned, I don't know that we've had any cases in Clark County, but we're concerned that it could become a significant problem here. So we're doing a couple of things. One is, and let me know if I'm going on too long, but one is in our syringe exchange where we encounter people who may be homeless, as well as obviously people who use who inject drugs, we're providing hepatitis A vaccine at our harm reduction center. We're working with the jail, and we're making progress in the jail to actually provide hepatitis A vaccine. I'd like to see it at the moment people come in and provide the vaccine. We're not doing extensive checks to determine whether somebody's been vaccinated or not before. The idea, getting an additional Hep A vaccine is not harmful, and the idea is to get people vaccinated as quickly as we can. We've reached out to the free clinic to possibly provide some hepatitis A vaccine in their through their mobile unit. We're still working on that. I don't know if you wanted me to add anything else about that. Oh, the other thing I should add about it is, in most people, hepatitis A is kind of a really nasty illness where you can be sick, a lot of nausea and vomiting. You turn jaundiced, but you're really pretty sick. But it's got a low, it's got relatively low morbidity in terms of death or hospitalization. In the cases we've seen in Washington, a hospitalization rate, and this is just off the top of my head, I think it's been close to 50%, which is unusual for Hep A. But it's in a population that has, you know, co-infected with Hep B, Hep C, may have other causes of liver disease, so it can be enough to push this population over the edge, which is another reason we'd like to see if we could prevent any more cases. Yes?
I just was, Joan won't be able to help me with this, I think. The day at the point in time count for people experiencing homelessness at, I think it was St. Joseph Catholic Church, they have this one day, bring all kinds of services to people that come there. And I was fortunate to get to spend one of the days there. And it was great. That seems like it'd be a great place to have this vaccine available, because they actually bring them in from camps by van and truckload. And it'd be an easy way to reach a lot of people.
Well, if there's a way to provide, we can supply the vaccine. It's a matter of having the folks, the staff, to administer it. Mm-hmm.
We're having the first meeting, the first planning meeting for Project Homeless Connect.
Great, or even have students can do, I don't know.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, it's now being organized. David Bilby is the, he's been contracted by the council for to organize it. So I can bring that up at the planning meeting, and certainly I could be with my students, and we could get students to help with that.
Okay, you probably need some standing orders and stuff.
If you can cover
that, that would be great. I mean, the more hepatitis A vaccine we can get out there to this population, the better off we'll be. And they will be. That's great. Thank you.
How often do they, does an adult get a Hep A injection? Like, what if they were vaccinated and they don't?
Yeah, that's so.
It doesn't sound like it's going to cause any problems.
There's two different kinds of vaccines. There's the Hep A vaccine that's combined with Hep B vaccine, and for that you need three injections. The pure Hep A vaccine, you need two. But even one vaccine, one shot gives you some protection, and one Hep A vaccine, one shot of the pure Hep A vaccine is very effective. So the bottom line is, in your lifetime, depending on the version you get, you need either two or three shots.
And that's it,
yes. But even one
provides,
it's kind of like MMR, you know, you need two, but even one provides, and it's a pretty good vaccine.
They don't booster it. So if a person knew that they had a Hep A injection in the past, they wouldn't.
Well, we'd want to give them at least two,
right?
If they can. But if they weren't sure, they couldn't remember, give them another. It's not going to hurt them.
Well, I can't remember. I want to make sure that I'm vaccinated. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you're going to travel, you want to get, you know, yeah, depending on where you're traveling. I traveled to India, I made sure I had two shots.
Do you want to give a flu update too?
Yeah, well, with the bottom line, well, I'm not going to show you this picture. So we we started our weekly updates about influenza, because we're at the time when we can get into the influenza season. For those of you who don't remember, to say that we're in influenza season, 10% of tests that physicians and other healthcare providers obtain have to be positive for influenza. We're like below 2%. You can't see this, but there's a dotted line at 10%. We're down here. So we'll be monitoring this pretty closely. That being said, we're really recommending that people get the flu shot now. It takes 2 weeks to build up immunity. We can't be sure when the flu season is going to start.
And the one shot is should protect you throughout the season, even if the season is late. I've heard and I've seen on social media that there's a delay in the higher dose vaccine for people 65 and older. And while there's some data that shows that there may be higher antibody levels and some additional effectiveness, there's a kind of wide confidence interval on that. The recommendation is don't delay on getting the vaccine. The CDC is recommending any of the products for adults, even those who are ages over 65. So you do not have to get the higher dose vaccine. You don't have to wait for that. So I wanted to get that point out there. In addition to being the best prevention there is for influenza, the vaccine also reduces the severity of it, including the need for hospitalization. So get the flu vaccine is out there and available, and we recommend that people get it now.
The data from the last influenza season and how protective the vaccine that was chosen for last year's, because they're kind of off on their time frame, was it pretty protective? Did they think that the vaccine for?
Yeah, I don't. It was fair, I believe, last year, if I remember correctly. I don't have any data on
how this year, no.
I mean, even it's been as low as 20%, and I believe as high as like in 60. Off the top of my head. The bottom line is, even at that level, at the lower level, it's more effective than anything else we can do to prevent influenza. We do need a better vaccine, but it's still the most effective thing we can do. I don't know if any of the other physicians in the room want to get anything. We're all in agreement. I'll take silence as agreement. And it is, by the way, the vaccine is incredibly safe. It's inexpensive, and again, it's the best thing we can do, but the vaccine, you can't get the flu from the flu shot. And everybody 6 months in age and older should get it. There's really rarely any medical reason why you shouldn't be getting the flu shot. No other questions?
All right. Sounds good.
Is there anything else I need to talk about, or you're done with me? Are you going to talk about the mental health sales?
It's
going to
be Jeff.
All right. As part of our 2020 budget submission, we requested just over $150,000 of additional mental health sales tax to expand our nursing home partnership program. Those new funds, as well as some of the funding we received last budget, will be called together to be used as a match for additional grant funding from the NFP National Services Office, NSO. It's a 2-to-1, two mental health sales tax dollars for every dollar of NSO matching grant funds. I'm very excited to see our NFP program continue to grow. That decision package and request has been pushed forward by the National Sales Tax Funding Committee, which Dr. Monique sits on. Their recommendation, we believe, is being looked upon favorably by the county council, so we believe that package will actually get approved. The other item is timing for the budget. For some odd reason, they moved the budget adoption public hearing from the first week of December to November 25th and 26th. A couple of councilors are not able to be here the first week of December, which I've never seen this. I've been here 21 years, I've never seen this happen. But November 25th and 26th are the public hearing for the adoption of our 2020 budget. So as of right now, there's no threats against our budget. We don't have any need for testimony on our behalf, but who knows next year. Any questions on the budget or mental health sales tax?
It would be good to have, with the growth of the Nurse Family Partnership Program, there's probably a lot of members of the council who aren't aware of the impact of that in the program, and it would be good if we could have an update on the Nurse Family Partnership Program, how many clients we're seeing, some historical, because it's such an incredible, I think it's the gold standard of research, being demonstrated to show the outcomes to families, and also saving huge amounts of taxpayer dollars, so yeah. It would be good to have a report.
Absolutely.
On that.
Okay, I can put that on the agenda. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if Michael is, or Dr. Melnick is going to do the, or maybe a combination of the two for the harm reduction center facility changes.
So I don't know if everyone's familiar with where our harm reduction center has been on Fourth Plain down the way a little bit. But we were informed a few weeks ago that that property had sold effective October 1st. And pretty much as soon as the new owner was taking possession of the property, they made it clear that they did not intend to renew our lease when it comes due at the end of June. So that has put us into a rather rapid timeline for real estate shopping. And we've been talking both with some commercial, you know, just regular commercial space, and also with some partners in the area to find a new home for that. We don't have a new home identified right now, but we have some good leads, and I'm pretty confident that we'll get someplace identified and, well ahead of our end of January lease termination. So, a little bit of a hump for us to have this happen, kind of unexpectedly, but we're hoping that we'll end up in a better spot when we move into our new location, wherever that might be.
And since East Health is here, just want to thank East Health is actually helping us identify.
Yeah,
locations.
Met with a real estate representative from East Health and looked at some facilities there, so that's certainly part of what we're looking at. So,
do you want to just give a quick synopsis on what the facility, you know, what the facility does, or just kind of?
Yeah, well, it's principally, and for those that met me last time, I've been here a couple months now, so I don't have the level of familiarity that Dan Nguyen, our program manager of that program, has, but I can give you my assessment of it, or my understanding of it, which it's been a facility for, well, the name says it all, working with folks who are using drugs to do harm reduction, and that means a variety of different things. What everybody sort of sees as the initial piece is syringe exchange, which is part of that, and that does several things for the community. Gets dirty needles off the street so they don't end up in some place they don't need to be, so that those can be disposed of properly. It puts clean needles in the hands of people that are using them so that they have a safer way to use. And then we're also working with them when they come in to exchange needles to look at other issues that might be going on. We do STD testing and some treatment there. We can refer them to treatment for other concerns that they have. And we also, and this is kind of a big deal for us, is we work with them towards how can we step them towards a recovery program, a treatment program. The statistic that Dana's been working on is, you know, every 5 visits you've significantly increased somebody's likelihood that they're going to move into treatment for their addiction. So that's the long-term strategy for working with the clients that we work with, but that's very much of a carrot model, if you will, and not a stick model. We don't have a stick, so we do have a carrot, which is, you know, working with them on syringe exchange, working with them on providing some treatment for STDs and other things, and providing them with a space where they can come in and be treated respectfully and with dignity as a way to build a rapport and build trust and hopefully help them move to a next step towards recovery. And with that in mind, one of the elements that we're looking for in a new location is, you know, that's why we're talking with some of our partners at Peace Health, is how do we partner more closely geographically, ideally with treatment facilities or treatment providers, so that we can make
that transition more seamless for the
patient. Is that the only facility in Clark County that provides that kind of service?
I'm sorry.
Is this the only facility that provides that kind of service for Clark County that is funded by
There's public? Some needle exchange that's done elsewhere, particularly I understand at the Navigation Center. I don't know of any place other than that. I'm looking at Roxanne.
So the Navigation Center is one area, and prior to Michael coming on board, we were working with that. They're actually not up and operational yet, but the intent is for there to be some service program at the Navigation Center. And then there are others in Cowlitz County, where it's not necessarily Clark County, but Southwest Washington. The FQHC there, correct?
Cowlitz Family Health
Correct, is doing a needle exchange program there.
And just while I have the floor, I guess I'm sort of struggling with allergies today. It's not the flu. Just a word, I guess, about demographics, that this is not, a population that is, it's a diverse population, but we have a lot of people that are seeking this service, that are coming in private cars, that have, a life of, with a job and a house and a more stable experience than I think of the general population. The general public sometimes has a mental image of harm reduction that doesn't really line up entirely with the reality of the folks that need this service. So there's really a lot more broader segment of society that is benefiting from the service that we're providing than I think sometimes people kind of come into the conversation thinking.
I can add one thing. The other services that the Harm Reduction Center provides is we've been distributing naloxone
yes,
in the past. Like at least five, I think we started that in 2014. And naloxone is an antidote to opioid overdose, which is now nationwide opioid overdose deaths, I think, exceed car wrecks in terms of deaths. So we've had hundreds and hundreds of reported reversals. The other thing that happens at the Harm Reduction Center is that there's an opportunity to get referred in for medication-assisted treatment. So that's also been shown it's really effective and actually increases people's chances of long-term recovery. So I just wanted to add that in case folks are wondering what we do there.
Yes, thank you. Okay. And Roxanne, you're going to do the firearm tragedy prevention.
So we sent you all a link to the Washington Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network meeting. The fall-winter meeting is going to be November 6th at the Water Resources Center. We sent out that link for RSVP if any of you are interested in going, and we can do that again. I have an agenda of what the topics will be, which is, it looks like it's going to be a really good meeting. I'm planning on being there. I know that we've got some legislators looking at be there, and some of our county councilors have said that they're going to be there as well, so I thought that was awesome. One of the topics will be firearm trends and child death review, and you all will be having an overview of child death review here in a few minutes, so we'll be presenting there. There will be an evaluation of the Safe Firearm Storage Giveaway events in Vancouver, Seattle, and Washington, and that's from Seattle Children's Hospital. There's also going to be a Washington State Violent Death Review System data update, and they keep data on violent death reviews, and they keep data on violent deaths, and they also look at specifically related to firearms, so they're going to be giving an update on that. Innovative suicide prevention practices in Washington. We've got a suicide prevention specialist who's going to be here from North Central Washington that's going to be presenting on that. Combating youth suicide, the importance of lethal means restriction, and the person who presented to us at our last meeting talked a little bit about that, those lethal restrictions, so they're going to be talking a little bit more in detail about that. Gun violence prevention and the role of the PTA, and then there'll be some wrap-up and some networking opportunities. So we'll put the link in the notes again, but if you all have any interest in going, please go ahead and RSVP to that event. There's still openings and places, so seats available if any of you would like to attend.
Okay. Then we're going to have our presentation and discussion. We're going to switch our order a little bit. We're going to do the child death review update and recommendation. Chris is going to give us that presentation first, and then we'll do the community health needs assessment update.
Okay. So I'm Chris Goodman. I coordinate our child death review efforts. I believe you've heard about it once or twice over the course of the last year here. Go to the next slide, please. So the general purpose of a child death review team and effort is to examine real-life examples of child deaths in order to identify potential gaps or opportunities in local policies, practices, or systems in the interest of preventing future child injuries and deaths. And in order to do this, we have a team that meets quarterly to review cases where youth 18 years old or younger have died for what we call non-natural causes. Now, these non-natural causes tend to include things like suicide, drowning, homicide, vehicle-related, other accidents, falls, things like that. So we won't have every youth death that happens come into our purview, but just those that may be preventable. The team itself consists of members of a cross-section of the community relating to the health, well-being, and livelihoods of our youth, and also that might have been involved in the investigations surrounding their deaths. This includes representatives from the medical examiner's office, the court and legal systems, Educational Service District 112, domestic violence, child protective services, law enforcement, EMS, and a few others as well. What we do is we gather as much documentation and records as we can about the event of a youth's death and also their life and any context that might be relevant. We get medical records, police records, mental health records, and EMS records, basically anything that we can from these partners at the table and a few others that we built a relationship with in order to get as deep and as broad of a case review as we can to understand the circumstances that led to a youth's death and to look for a gap or an opportunity for improvement that might be applied by a partner or a community or anywhere to help prevent something from happening in the future. This is not something that we invented. It is one of many child death review teams in the country. It is a national program run out of, I believe it's Michigan, from the National Center for Fatality Review and Prevention. And they provide trainings and guidelines and also manage a national data system so that they can get that population view of what's happening with youth deaths that are potentially preventable. The work itself is protected and encouraged by Washington state law with this, because it's such sensitive information that we're looking at. We're not spreading around these documents. It's all coming to me, and it basically stops there with our team here in public health. And then we'll share information that's relevant out to the team behind closed doors. Nothing leaves that room. No one talks about it with any kind of identifiable information who's not on the team, and also none of that information that is talked about in the room is able to be subpoenaed or used for legal purposes as well. So we can really commit to having an open and thorough discussion to meet those ends. Next slide, please. So we had our first meeting in December last year, so we're less than a year old. We've had four meetings thus far to review the cases from calendar year 2018. We have identified 19 cases that we qualify for death review from 2018, and these included suicides, sudden unexpected infant deaths, vehicle-related deaths, homicides, and drowning, with the two top ones being, most frequent ones being suicide and sudden infant death. Four of these deaths happened in Oregon, which presents a whole slew of difficulties in getting more information, so we're not always able to have as thorough a discussion about those ones as we are the ones that occurred in Washington State. Indeed, for two of them, we don't even have names. We just know a little that it happened, which is something that we're still working on. And I've been talking to some folks in Oregon, and we've had some opportunities to maybe get a little more connectivity with them on this subject. As this work can be very long and it can be very trying, but we have been able to come up with, which is actually pretty rare among child death review teams, to come up with some recommendations in our first year of being. I think this is a very important thing to focus on, and I've been very fortunate in being supported and having the time to really dig into this stuff and find ways to make it useful and to help cultivate our team. We've come up with a couple of recommendations that we are currently working on or researching. One is relating to safe sleep education and practices. So looking at these sudden unexpected infant deaths, based on our reviews, I went out and I talked to educators at the birth centers in our community, at the hospitals, and got a feel for what things are going on there. And we talked about opportunities for maybe doing a little bit better with that. And so from that, what we're intending to do is we're working on developing a handout, basically, based on the best practice guidelines for safe sleep, and to translate it into Spanish, Russian, and Chinese, so that the parents can walk out of there having been educated verbally and ideally verbally in their native language, and also given something they can take home in their native language to assure that at least the education is being provided in a way that is more understandable and also maybe relatable to whoever else might be a caregiver for the child at home. And that's something, once we have it produced, we'll work with the hospitals to see about implementing. Another thing that we're looking at very closely, stemming from a more recent meeting where we finished out looking at suicide cases. At this point, we're just researching some various angles that came up in discussion. And these include generally how we look at suicide data in general, who's doing it, to what extent, what's being done with that information, frequency, looking at other variables. We're talking about looking at the possibility of reinvigorating a youth suicide prevention coalition. There was one a while ago. It sort of dissolved over the years, and there might be some opportunity there. We're thinking about how best to manage communication and trauma of other youth after this happens. So kind of a peripheral piece of this that might not prevent the suicides themselves, but could provide an opportunity to better take care of the mental health and trauma of the other youth. And the last piece too that we're looking into is safe home storage for firearms. So we're working, and definitely looking forward to giving you some more information and having those recommendations implemented. We will be doing internal tracking and reporting for the first couple years. There's few enough cases that we cannot really talk about them without risking them being personally identifiable. But after we have a few years of information, we'll be able to produce a public report that we can share. So I want to give an opportunity for any particular questions about the program.
Chris, does the National Center have any kind of reports that they've put out over, you know, it would be interesting if we could get a link to maybe one of their reports too, just see what's going on nationally.
Yeah, I can share some of that stuff with you. They have a great mailing list that just constantly is coming out with really, really important and relevant studies and whatnot. Their database has been used by research universities and health departments to really take a good look at some of this data. So I'll share that and maybe a recent report of theirs. If you want an example, too, of some other recommendations that have come out, other CDR teams in the state have produced 3 or 5 year reports. I think there's one from Seattle King County that was a 5 year report that was pretty thorough and had some great examples of what they did with this program. And they've been around for a little while yet, so they can do that.
Well, you know, it's just like, you know, the whole thing about safe sleep. I know that when my daughter had my grandson, let me tell you that before she leave the hospital, she had to watch the video and the training on Purple Crying twice, 2 or 3 times, and it seems that the safe sleep is, you know, it's so well established about the back to sleep programs, et cetera, that it should be a part of education. And I probably didn't get anything about safe sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, you got all this about Purple Crying, but not about safe sleep.
And then when you add on to that, people that are not native English speakers, they just don't have the resources.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing, it's very cultural, too. So, you know, co-sleeping is there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of cultures that just do that.
And so how to provide the information in a way that's not antithetical to their cultural norms, and that also doesn't single out people, especially, you know, there's folks that, you know, want to co-sleep with their infants because of safety issues as well. So we have to be very cognizant of that when we're developing these recommendations and not having under any unintended consequences of these recommendations where we are inadvertently shaming people or, you know, going against their cultural norms. Because the thing is, we want them to accept the information. And if we're not culturally, you know, sensitive to what their needs are, they're not going to listen to the information. So we really want to make sure that when we're looking at this, we're considering those issues as well. Yeah.
What is purple crying? I mean, I just have babies.
Good question.
What is the purple crying video that she had to watch? What is purple crying? Sorry.
It's crying is, they don't understand. You know, the reason, but the babies that just cry, it's like colic, they just cry and cry and they can't be consoled.
Uh-huh.
And it puts a family at risk for abuse.
It's kind of a shaken baby, that's what they're...
And it's called purple crying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they just, and they don't understand it, and kids that have purple, I didn't know about it until I had to watch the video.
Just wondering what the education
kids
is.
Kids that have purple crying, when they grow up, there's no signs of any adverse effects. They just don't understand what causes it. And some children or some infants and others, but it's a risky situation for families if the baby's constantly crying. You know, for shaking baby or
I didn't have those videos
crying.
I didn't know what those videos. What that meant. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a recent experience with my daughter and her husband having to sign off that they had viewed that video, and I was with them when they watched it, so I know exactly what you're talking about. But it is about preventing harm because of the helplessness that parents might feel and not really have good coping mechanisms to be willing to just leave the child in a safe place and step away and calm down.
Yeah, give strategies for how to deal with it too. Mm-hmm. So, but it seems to me that the back to sleep, you know, certainly being culturally appropriate, et cetera, is important, but that's been around for a long time, right? About, you know, safe sleep for infants. Mm-hmm. Will we change from the, you know, from the being on the tummy to be the back to sleep programs? And
Chris, how do you know the program's going to work? What are the success metrics for the program?
As far as making recommendations that stick? Yeah. Or like just in general for child health issues?
Yeah, in general, I guess. It seems like the numbers are so low, thank goodness, that it's going to be hard to prove efficacy.
That is an excellent point. We are fortunate in having recently hired Haley, who I believe you guys have met recently, who is an evaluation specialist of some sort, who's going to help us with our own tracking. But yeah, it presents a very... we're never, I don't think, just my opinion, going to know for sure that this caused a preventive event. But I think that maybe we'll return to the National Center and see what they say, which I don't know off the top of my head.
So one of the purposes of doing this, you guys are uploading data to the National Center, right? So you're right, the numbers, the N is really small in terms of figuring stuff out, but everybody, it's a standardized way that folks across the country are entering data into this national database. And that's where a lot of mining can go on in terms of looking at risk factors. So it's a much more robust data set. And I assume you guys will be looking at that as well, right? We have some access there.
Yes.
So the identifiers are obviously, there are not names in there, but it's a robust national data set that is going to enable people to take a look at these and see if they can identify what some of the, you know, if you just look locally, you're not going to be able to identify those risk factors as well. Yes, I hope that answers your question.
Kind of a background thing running as the research piece. Each case we do report is dozens and dozens of variables and factors for each case that they can cross-reference.
And the other thing that there's a lot of variables they're looking at that would not be, for example, in a medical record. So you get people. So I don't know whether CPS folks are involved or so when you convene these panels, you involve people whose data may not be in the medical record. So
somebody from CPS who comes and reviews this case with you said, oh, this child has been a CPS case. There's other things going on that if you just looked at the medical record, you might not identify. And this all goes into this national database.
So the biggest benefit is the data, because we didn't have the data before we started this review.
It would be neat to hear about what the national database is showing.
I'll definitely share some stuff with you folks. And one other piece too is these gaps and opportunities can take infinite forms, basically. And it could be as simple as, like, some things might be seen a little bit more common sense once you look at it. Like, if we had a case where a youth was referred for counseling but never got to that counseling, we can look at that and hone in on it and be like, what happened? What made it so this youth didn't, you know, make it to that counselor, which might have prevented this thing from happening? And then figure out how to close that gap. Oh, this agency wasn't talking to that agency. Or they had a plan, but the person who wrote it left, and so now there's no longer a relationship. Things like that come out of, are part of the benefit of having these multiple sourced data reviews.
Do you anticipate, Chris, that too, that there will be policy changes that you could also report on through this? So, kind of to your point, as these agencies recognize where those gaps are, will they be implementing some policy changes that might be able to be part of a new form of use?
That's one of the primary angles for CDL work in general. As far as our team goes, we're still very young. This work, like I mentioned, frequently takes several years before they really get something out of it. So it's a long haul, requires a lot of, I think, attention and patience.
Great un-American tech abuse.
You're doing it. It has to be that way. So if you have any further thoughts or questions later on, please don't hesitate to call or email. I'm happy to talk about it some more.
Thank you, Chris. And then we'll do the community health needs assessment update from David.
Yes, so I'm going to talk about what community, go to the next slide, what the community health needs assessment is, why we participate, who participates, really what we get out of this, and kind of where we're going from here. So just to give you kind of a quick overview of what community health needs assessment is, ultimately it results in a very extensive report. And this initiative called the Healthy Columbia Willamette Collaborative is an assessment of the metro region. So all four counties in the metro region, including seven health systems. And it's one of the more unique formal relationships that we have with Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. And as I always say, our work does not stop at the river, including communicable disease. If you look at what happened with the measles outbreak, chronic disease, emergency preparedness, amongst other things. So. It's really important that we participate in this, and I think what we're also seeing is that from a funding perspective, a lot of our funders are looking now at not funding just individual counties or communities, but they're actually looking at funding regions. So that's one of the results of participating in this, is that we have better relationships with our partners across the river. And we are in touch with their grant writers, and we've talked about writing joint grants together. So in terms of the report itself, can you go to the next slide? These are the core issues that are identified, and the report itself is 195 pages long, so it's very extensive, and you'll have a link to it. We can email this out to you. The key drivers of all these issues were discrimination, racism, and trauma. And we know that racism and discrimination are included as part of the social determinants of health, or the key issues that drive health. And so that we found that as we did this assessment report. So what it included was a lot of data collection, and we didn't use the core data sources like the census or hospital discharge data, the healthy youth survey that we do in the schools every 2 years, the National Behavior Risk Surveillance System, that's a telephone survey. This really was from the community.
So it's really the voice of the community is what they see as the health issues in their communities or their neighborhoods. So there were 18 listening sessions in the metro region, and over 200 people participated. So that information, all qualitative, really was what made up this report. Can you go to the next one? So although this is an assessment of the key health issues of the metro region, and that's what we're looking at, how we collectively can address these issues, people in Clark County obviously want to know what was it that stood out for Clark County. And one of the appendices in the report itself is all of the Clark County data. So when we send out the link for this, whether it's in this presentation or the link itself, you can go to that appendices and then look at the Clark County data. But again, I just want to stress that when we look at it, we're looking at it collectively across the metro region. But there were some really good news from a health perspective for Clark County, and you'll see that we had the lowest percentage of eighth graders that were food insecure in the Four County region, the lowest percentage of eighth graders that smoke, and those that use drugs without a prescription. And then we have the highest percentage of all residents that get routine checkups. So, you know, people ask, why is this? And we have our assumptions, but we don't really know why we see this. And these results, too, it's very insignificant in terms of the percentage difference between the counties. And that was really the case for all the data points in the report. It was pretty similar across the board. So this is just a link, and since it's long, we'll send this out to you. Let's see, I want to just make a couple other points. So in terms of like next steps, again, the committee of the four counties and seven health systems, we're looking at the results of the report and looking like collectively, how can we address this? And it helps us identify the priorities in our work. Not just here at Clark County, but again as a region. And then it also helps us with our improvement plans in developing those. And as a result of participating in the collaborative, there's some things that came out of it. I mentioned the joint grant writing and funding opportunities, but we are going to be participating in a regional opioid work group. There's a suicide prevention work group at the regional level. And I know that issue has been talked about in the past on this committee. And then also there's a joint data sharing agreement that Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Clark County are working on. So any questions about the community health needs assessment?
David, also some of our partners in the community are also utilizing this data for their own. So some of our clinical partners, Casol, for instance, I think Legacy Media, are using this information for their own health needs assessments as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also Swatch.
Right. Southwest Accountable Community of Health.
Yes.
Okay.
And I have the opportunity to be a Peace Health rep on this committee for about 2 years, I think, a little bit more. And the things that my wishes for some of the evolution of the work would be that because it's based on the voice of the community and not many other typically utilized resources, that the report, at least at my time, it sounds like it's still the case, and being in almost 200 pages, and having read it, it didn't seem to me like it would be easily available and digestible and relevant to the people whose voices were utilized.
Okay.
So I really wish to see that connection really be strong, so that if what we are attempting to do is to reach out to these folks, get their feedback, get their voices or concerns, and then create something that they can look at and say, this is what we said.
Okay.
And then further to be able to say, now what is the utility of the report in terms of having impact in those areas of concern in a rapid enough cycle that you can actually see pathway to success before people get discouraged and move on to the next relevant or issue of concern.
Right.
So those were just some things I threw out there because I wasn't on there long enough to see how it would evolve in a way that might meet my desires. And I'm sure there were many things about it that were really good, but those were a couple areas that I felt could be better.
Okay, that's good feedback. I will definitely pass that along as we talk about kind of next steps. So this report is done, this assessment's done every 3 years. So we're starting planning for the fourth one, which we'll pick a contractor this summer in July, and then it'll be completed 2 years after that. And it's also a requirement for public health accreditation. Did you want to add something, Roxanne?
No, I was just going to say one of the criticisms that we often get in public health and other public services is we often engage, you know, the community. We want your voice.
Yeah.
But then we forget that to close that loop.
Yes. Right.
And so this is another great, reminder that we need to not fall into that trap of, hey, give us all your data, and then, thanks, and we'll never hear from us again, kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah,
right.
Great point. So thank you.
And to be fair, though, having worked on community health needs assessment for Peace Health, I experienced myself how easy it is to seek that information from the community and to greatly appreciate it, but getting the information back is not easy to do. And that's why I think how it is packaged is really important to make it more widely accessible.
That's good. Any other questions?
What do you think that really surprised you about it this year?
No, I don't think so. I guess one thing that surprised us maybe is they called out isolation. We heard that repeatedly in a listening session. And that was kind of interesting because I think sometimes we forget about that from a health perspective, of that social support and how important that is. And in some ways, some data points, we actually scored lower, our county did, than the other three counties.
Speaking of like seniors or people that are living alone or isolation, like food desert isolation.
Rural communities, and I think one of the reasons that we scored a little lower there is that the northern part of our county is very rural. So,
social isolation.
It's just that not feeling connected within their communities. So, yeah, that was one. It was just a good reminder of how important that is and the impact of connectedness is to health.
Some of the more elderly populations, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's a core component of ACEs as well.
Yeah.
And, and just having traumatic experiences,
right,
and that social isolation can lead to prevention or, resiliency from being fully, fully being realized.
Yeah.
That social isolation is a huge problem.
It would be interesting, when the report was first released, there was some really good press coverage by the Columbia. But there needs to be more ongoing would be another way to get it to the public, is to, go in depth on maybe some of these different things and try to get that in the, in the local news. Because when it was first released, of course, the headlines was that, racism was a big issue this year.
Yeah.
But then we haven't seen anything more since that. So we could do that. That also helps get the word back to some of the people who participated.
We may want to talk with Marissa when she gets back.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that, social media, we post a lot of stuff there. Mm-hmm. And we could probably keep on posting, putting pieces of this out there ongoing.
We have talked about that in the communications team with Marissa as well. So we have some intent at least to take pieces of that and feature them. At the very least through our social media outlets and share with our partners too. So.
Well, just the issue of social isolation. It's across the board issue. I certainly see it with my students working with the seniors, but it's also with people, who live in communities who don't know their neighbors, and they just wither. I mean, they just, especially in low-income neighborhoods, you know, and so, and there's a relationship there between poverty and social isolation, and so I think, you know, to home in on a couple of those topics, and
yeah.
I think would be really interesting for, you know, the general public who had a voice in bringing some of these issues forward.
Years ago, we used to have somebody from Columbia would attend most meetings, mm-hmm. and every once in a while, we'd get a good article out of it, or maybe a little Sunday feature. Mm-hmm. It seems like some of this information would be kind of neat for us.
Mm-hmm. They came to this meeting?
Years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name of the reporter. What was it?
I think B-O-E-G-T. I don't remember what he looks like. He's retired.
Oh, Tom Vogt
used to come to him. I don't know what the staffing at the Columbia
is. I think that's part of it.
The great thing is that Marissa used to be a reporter at the Columbian, so she's got a lot of contacts. And, you know, the thing is, to your point, I mean, putting out press releases is really good, developing those relationships with media so we can get the word out in an accurate way, too. Because this can be, you know, it can be a little controversial, and we want to make sure that we get out in front of that versus, you know, having it get out there and then explaining it. We want to make sure that our messages are out there in advance so people understand what the report really does say and what it doesn't say.
Well, I think a lot of parents like to see how well are they doing right. individually with their kids compared to
right.
some of the statistics.
Right, yeah.
What are the controversial questions?
Well, I think the issue of racism has come up as being a little bit of a controversial subject and how that interplays with health status. So we've heard some comments back about that. David, I don't know if you have anything else that you want to share that you've heard.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. But we know nationally that it is a social determinant of health that we have to address, that we look at funding opportunities, it's always called out.
Well, there's a lot of, besides the qualitative data, there's a lot of quantitative data out there about healthcare inequities and disparities and, you know, by race. And I mean, it's well known. The town hall is, or the qualitative stuff is confirming by people's perception, but the data are out there. Even when you control for socioeconomic factors and just look at race in terms of health outcomes, you find a difference. There's a ton of literature about this stuff.
I keep hoping we're past all that.
So the executive committee update, we are going to develop a nominating committee that will need to meet in November to present some nominations for our election of the new kind of chair representatives. They will present the information in December, and then with our new schedule, we will probably hold our election in February, so we'll vote in February. They'll present the nominees in December, is this correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then we will vote in February.
Yes.
So do we need to have people that volunteer for the nominating committee? And generally, I think we've had three. So it's going to be just probably one meeting. And I think Innovate Jones been on it a couple of years, and Steve was on it again.
It's a fun little committee.
It's a party.
Usually we do it on the telephone, and so
it shouldn't take too long. So
our bylaws require that the meeting happens in November.
So the slate is presented in November, and then the voting happens in following meeting.
The committee meets in November. The slate is presented in December.
Right.
And then we will vote at our next regular meeting, which will be in February.
And the committee presents the slate of, do they let the nominees know that they are being presented?
I believe so,
undercover mission.
Be careful if you don't attend a meeting.
Right.
don't get nominated.
Yeah. You don't want to be nominated, then you may want to be on this meeting. No. Okay. Are there any people that are just dying to be on the nominating committee?
It's not a lot of work.
I'll do it again. I mean, if
I'll do it.
I would do it too. So,
Remy and Adrian.
Yeah.
Well, being on the nominating committee doesn't guarantee that you're not one of the nominees. If you guys think that you can avoid that by being on the nominating committee.
Well, if you look at the nominating committee and they have not been on the chair since, not been on the board,
yeah,
or not been on the. Right.
Okay.
Great. And to get that together, we'll just kind of talk individually.
And I think it's important if people are interested, you know, we sort of gauge, you know, just people's interest by, you know, you have to have had some experience on the council. But if somebody's interested, please let Darlene know so she can let us know, because, and there's no shame in saying you'd like to be on the executive council, because it's a great opportunity to.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, great. And then we already did Dr. Yusuf's award, so congratulations. Our next meeting will be December 10th, so we will not have a meeting. We're on our schedule, so no November meeting, and our December meeting will be someplace different. It's at Luke Jensen Sports Complex, which I hear is, well, I've been there for soccer, but I hear that there's a building, and then there's a conference space above.
Correct. The conference space is right above the concession stand, so it smells weirdly of hot dogs and.
Is that we're going to have? Yeah.
Probably not in December, though, will it? Or
yeah,
maybe.
No, probably not, unfortunately. But anyway, yeah, so it's an octagonal building, and when you see the complex, it's the only building there, and that the conference room is on the top. The entrance to the community room is around the back, so when you park in the parking lot, you'll come around the back, and the entrance to upstairs is around the back. We'll provide a map for you in advance.
And that is the second Tuesday, like normal. Yeah, the 10th, it seems early.
Right.
Okay.
And by the way, we do have a list.
Do you mind if I say
yes,
that?
Please. We do have a list of all the meeting dates that's in your packet, and that was also emailed out to you. We're also sending email invites, but we understand that some who have maybe Apple products, the Outlook invitations may not be synchronizing very well with your calendars. So if you could just use this list to confirm that you have those on your calendars, that would be great.
I have a question that I want to bring forth, because you have an opening on your agenda here.
Yeah, go ahead.
My neighbor down the street from me, wrote up an issue that she's with the parent teachers organization at one of the schools, and she was interested in hearing about how lice is in schools. Seems like there's a constant problem with the school where her kids are, and there doesn't seem to be any regulations as far as the kids coming to school with lice. She said she knows one little girl that has her head constantly shaved, and then there's another one that has a full head of hair, and sitting at in the cafeteria, you can almost see them going. So therefore, she doesn't know whether this parent even does anything about this, and so how can that be? Is there some regulation that follows
suit? Sure. Facts about head lice.
Yeah.
So lice don't jump. So the good news about lice is that they don't jump. So the only way kids are really at risk for lice from each other is if they're sharing clothing, you know, they're having direct contact that way. So there's no evidence that like a no-knit policy is or regulation is going to prevent or encourage or do anything about head lice. I do think, and you know, you don't have to use chemicals. You know, you can comb the nits out and keep on working at them. But I think if there's a child in a school that has lice that are, you know, crawling around in their head, and the parents aren't doing anything about it, I think those parents probably do need to be spoken to. I mean, I have some concerns about other factors in that child's life in terms of their welfare besides the lice crawling around. But I don't think a regulation is going to prevent that.
I think you could do it. You could do a challenge like before, Child Protective Services, and have somebody, you could do it anonymously, somebody come out and either talk to you at the school or go out to the house and then be able to check the condition of the house. Because like Dr. Mellon's right, that you're not taking care of your child with that. They're probably not being, you know, fed properly and a lot of other things.
Yeah, because lice are eminently, you can take care of them. Yeah. And they're not, you don't have outbreaks in schools. It's just not how they work. But I agree. If the child is continuously ridden with lice, there's something else likely going on.
The other thing is our FCRCs are doing a lot of work with that. They'll actually work with the parents to provide, you know, because sometimes you take somebody who, you know, you've got to have a washer and a dryer, and sometimes families don't have the capacity, and that's where our FCRC coordinators will help with that. And so to make a referral, you know, at the school, and teachers are really pretty good about that.
It's another social determinant, right?
And that's the family resource centers, right?
Yeah.
That's
and I think what the literature has said is it's more harmful for the child to be held out of school than going to school and then educating the parents and teachers and everybody about how to prevent the spread. And it's about contact with hair products and hats and jackets.
Right.
And
there's no reason. There's no medical reason for keeping these children out of school. And you're absolutely right, it's more harmful to keep them out of school.
The thing about it seems like, as this parent indicated to me, the ones that have the kids that have the lice don't seem to be doing anything about it. So that's the question.
But like John was saying, it could very well be a social.
Yeah,
I mean, there could be any number of reasons. And generally, the school is never aware of that.
I know a lot of teachers, frontline teachers, a lot of times what they will do is they will refer to family resource centers, or they will, if there's a school nurse available, they'll bring the school nurse in, and they've done. I know there was a little bit of an issue with my grandkids' school, and the school was fantastic about really bringing resources. And a lot of times the parents don't have a lot of resources, and part of it is, you know, making sure that they're aware of, you know, where they can get care for this, and, you know, providing transportation and other things to help the parents out. And what the school has found is that really does make a huge difference. So it could very well be that you know, maybe these parents just haven't been hooked up to those resources yet, but they definitely are available. And the family resource centers are just such a great option for parents that have that kind of a need. So that might be one suggestion for the parent, is that they could contact the family resource center.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just telling Marla. I mean, you know, my poor sister, when she was a kid, she had lice 3 times, you know. I mean, it's not a socioeconomic factor. It's just really sort of endemic, right, in our, it's kind of like bed bugs.
Anybody can get lice, but, you know, the point that Jones says is that, you know, you exclude a kid from school, you have these regulations. Some of these kids already have trauma in their life, and that's just re-traumatizing them more. And it's got to be hard for a kid, you know, with lice in school. Bullying or whatever else can happen to them.
Well, and then, you know, you just think about the time it takes if a child has long hair, and that's something that's very important in that family's life. For a girl with long hair, they're not going to cut the hair, and yet it takes hours to comb, you know, that. And so, and sometimes parents just don't have that amount of time, and so that's where they need some support.
By the way, that's where the term nitpicking comes from. But that just, you know, that's the time it takes to do it.
That down.
Nitpicking.
The origin of the word. Okay. Marla, did you have a question, or did you have?
Okay.
I just wanted to let you know, I'll stand up because I can't see everybody, but I'm going to be retiring February 14th. So I'm going to be resigning my position here in December. It's been a fabulous ride for me. Started it in 1973 as an Explore Scout for Allen County Sheriffs back in the days, believe it or not, before the portable radios. And I can remember female deputies first coming into patrol, and they still had to wear skirts with their guns and purses. And then I did. I started as an MP for 3 years and started my professional career. So I'll be going into 40 years.
Wow.
And so it's going to be fun. Looking forward to my next chapter, see what we can do. So I didn't get this one quite right, so I got to do it all.
They're going to miss you.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah. I'll see you one more meeting, and then I'll be out of here.
Bob, are you staying in the area? Or?
Yeah, we'll stay in the area at least half the time, at least the nice part of the year.
Yeah, yeah, plans for the next part of your career? Or,
no, I got to go find a job. My wife gets spending money.
We might have some openings in public health, so.
Great. That's really cool. Any other comments? Closing comments? We're done for you early.
Okay. All right.
Can I accept this?
I looked through her head. My brother.